KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You listen, if you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all white lights,
peaches
and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood, Hollywood.
This week on The Business, Carson Daly. He hosts The Voice and The Late Night Show, and every morning he's on the radio. He tells us how he does it and how he's had to fight to keep his late night show going through turmoil and budget cuts. But first, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood, Hollywood.
I'm joined in the studio by my banter buddy, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, a real kerfuffle, a sort of an improbable kerfuffle, I would say, over this movie that has not yet started shooting, Kill Bin Laden. Catherine Bigelow and Mark Boal, who were the director and writer of The Hurt Locker, had been working on this for a long time, and all of a sudden, it's a bigger deal than you might think.
Right-wing critics tend to hate Hollywood, and they really tend to hate Hollywood when it's making a movie that they think might be political. And the movie isn't made, and it's still being written. But this was all set off by a column in the New York Times by Maureen Dowd, where she wrote that Boal and Bigelow, quote, are getting top-level access to the most classified mission in history, unquote. And I think the right feels that this could potentially be, especially given its release date, which will be before the elections next year, some sort of infomercial praising Barack Obama and the mission. And so they have claimed that the filmmakers should not have this access and that the White House should not be working with the filmmakers.
Well, more than that, Representative Peter King, a Republican of New York who also has issues with mosques that may or may not be adjacent to the World Trade Center and may or may not be mosques, he had called. He's the chairman of the House Committee on Homeland Security. He called for the CIA and the Department of Defense to investigate whether the White House has done favors for Bigelow and Sony Pictures to give them access to confidential information.
But as a colleague of mine pointed out of the paper, if you read the recent New Yorker magazine article about the raid itself, there's tons of classified information that's in that story, or apparently classified information. A lot of people have been writing about this raid. Mark Boal, who wrote The Hurt Locker and is working on this project, is himself a journalist. So journalists have a right to figure out what really happened, and the film will probably reflect some version of that truth, but I don't think it's going to compromise national security, and it sure doesn't sound like they're actually getting information that other people are not.
The military has given a lot of assistance to filmmakers like Jerry Bruckheimer and Michael Bay when they are doing rah-rah pro-military movies. So it seems to me that this is an issue perhaps because the one who actually knocked off Osama bin Laden and his administration happens to be a Barack Obama. I'm going to guess that if it were, you know, one of the Bushes, the Republicans would be like rolling the film on the set to make this thing happen.
I think you're absolutely right.
Cynical me. And in another cynical vein, perhaps, News Corp reported good earnings and Rupert Murdoch had another chance to proclaim on a call with investors and journalists that he was shocked to find gambling in Casablanca or phone hacking at News Corp. He didn't know a thing about it, and it's inappropriate and wrong.
No, his direct quote is, I've run this company for more than 50 years. The kind of behavior that occurred in that newsroom has no place in News Corp. I would edit that comment to say the kind of behavior that we've just found out about. I mean, that behavior has been going on for years. So maybe it has no place in News Corp. I think it has no place being discovered in News Corp, and that's the real issue.
Well, I've talked to a lot of former News Corp execs, who none of whom believes he didn't know about this before when they were paying out big settlements, but he defended his own chairmanship of News Corp and his own executive role. I think he sounded a little more frisky than he did in that hearing at Parliament where he looked dazed and confused. And he defended his son James as his successor.
And in other news, Kim, I have to give you some props for your story about what really happened on The Walking Dead. This is a AMC show that we have talked about, written and kind of created by Frank Darabont, who is the force behind The Shawshank Redemption and other movies. And it turns out that even in success, AMC didn't quite want to meet the cost of the show.
It turns out Frank Darabont was summarily fired 3 days after he was kept around to hype the show at Comic-Con. The cast and crew were very upset. And what we learned in our reporting is that, you know, yes, the budget of the show had been severely cut by about $650,000 per episode. And this is their biggest ratings hit at AMC. Cast and crew very, very upset. A lot of fans very upset. Frank Darabont is not an easy guy. And, you know, it seems that what the feeling on the set has been is that his pushback to try to protect this show has upset AMC, which came up with cost-cutting suggestions like shoot more interiors. And as one of my sources said to me, you know, the zombies don't sit around the dinner table and chat. So it's not, you know, can't we hear the zombies and not see them to save money? And this is the kind of thing that Darabont apparently pushed back against. You know, for AMC, though, it's tough because they are a business. They're trying to make money.
No, and they tried to squeeze Mad Men by putting more commercial time in it. So AMC is still trying to figure out. I mean, they're kind of new to the success of Hollywood, and I think they're still learning how to crawl, even though in many ways they're running.
Well, and two quick points. They've just become part of a public company. They were spun off with Sundance Channel and some other channels from the parent company into AMC Networks. So they're on their own financially. Their numbers will be more transparent. And this is the only show that they own outright. So they bear all the risk as well as the potential upside. They developed and shot a pilot for Mad Men, but decided it was too risky to own it and sold it off to Lionsgate and licensed it back. So this is a big gamble for them. And the question is, are they helping themselves or hurting themselves by trying to control the budget?
And I guess we'll find out when the new episodes without Frank Darabont arrive.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. For years, NBC, the network once renowned for must-see TV, has been a punchline. But now there's hope. This spring, NBC got a new head of programming, the well-regarded Robert Greenblatt from Showtime. And this summer, it had its first breakout hit in years. The Voice is a singing competition imported from Holland. It has coaches, they aren't called judges, who mentor the contestants. When The Voice started pulling in big ratings, NBC's Greenblatt called it a rare gift from God.
Hey, everybody, I'm Carson Daly. Welcome to The Voice. This is the semifinals. And these are our superstar coaches. Give it up for Adam Levine, CeeLo Green, Christina Aguilera, and Blake Shelton.
Carson Daly is a professional host with a strong background in music. He was a late-night DJ on K-Rock, a commercial music station in L.A., before becoming a VJ on MTV's Total Request Live in 1998. A few years later, he started hosting a late-night show on NBC, and against the odds, he's kept that show alive for nearly a decade. Last year, he also started hosting a morning drive radio show in Los Angeles. With his television and radio gigs, he's a busy man, and over the years, he's also produced and hosted NBC's New Year's Eve show. But it was The Voice that brought Carson Daly into primetime. I asked him how that job came about.
I was in a room pitching other ideas that I had, and they had turned to me and said, "No, we think we finally have the right thing for you, you know, for your brand, for music, and it's this show from Holland called The Voice." And they showed me a little sizzle reel on the Dutch version.
And did they say, you know, this is yours if you want it, or would you
like
to?
They offered it to me in the room.
They did.
Mm-hmm. But in my mind early on when he said, we have a show, it's a reality music competition series, it's in prime time, I immediately, in my mind, judged it. And I thought, I think I know what that show is. It's probably an idol-type show that's not nearly as good. And I'm not interested. I'm not interested in music, especially being at the center of some form of comedy for television or counter-programming or whatever your intentions are. I'm probably not interested.
And who is the he in this scenario? You said he.
I'm talking to Paul Telegdy.
The head of reality.
Yes. Okay. And I was in a meeting in his office pitching him like a Barbara Walters interview idea I had for myself just to try and get on the network other than when America's Fast Asleep. And he said, we think we have a show for you. And he said Mark Burnett's going to produce it.
Let me just pause and say Mark Burnett, of course, is the father of many huge reality shows, starting with Survivor and moving forward from there.
Yeah. And now to me, I know how much Mark Burnett charges. So I said, this must be a high priority. And after a lot of conversations and talking about who's going to be there and the level of production and the quality and the, you know, all that, they said all the right things. They wanted this to be a through and through, a full quality music show, not making fun of people. And I loved the idea.
Although it is kind of, I mean, you got the flames and the
chairs. Well, I saw the big red chairs. That was the first thing I thought.
I mean,
went,
it's
oh,
not
no
exactly
way.
Like, yeah.
Well, for television, you know, for primetime television, and from my experience, and I've been in the music business on television for over 15 years, it is at the highest possible level of undiscovered artist ever shot on television.
Were the coaches in place when you came in?
Adam Levine was the first person that they had said, like, is in. And Adam, I was happy to find out because I'd given Maroon 5 their late night TV debut, and I've known him for a long time and been a fan of his. And I know that he's reluctant to do these sorts of shows. So that was actually a good thing. Christina Aguilera was the first person that I had said out loud was, well, you have to get somebody like Christina, right? I mean, that was the other thing, was trying to figure out what level of celebrity you're talking about for these coaches, not judges. And when they were saying at the level of Christina Aguilera, I thought, wow, okay, well, you guys are really serious about that. So it was Adam first, and then I knew about Christina, then CeeLo, and then Blake Shelton.
And did you imagine that it was going to do that kind of an – I mean, it came out of the gate very big.
I figured the show has to open, because if it doesn't open, the new formula for a new NBC with Comcast at the helm is really going to take – this almost could be something you couldn't recover from programming-wise.
Really?
Because it was so all in.
Mm-hmm.
Had it underwhelmed, I don't know. But what is underwhelming on NBC at this point? The question was, is this a network that's capable of getting 10, 11, 12, 15, 18? Can we get to those big, big eyeballs? Can they do that now? And of course we can.
Oh, well, let me pause for a second on the NBC of it all, because NBC has obviously been through the most ridiculous turn in the barrel of any network that I can remember since I've been covering this beat.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a new owners in Comcast coming in. And I'm sure you seem like a guy who's aware of all of this and how it impacts your life. So what was it like to watch that? I mean, the years of trouble when
so exciting.
GE and Jeff Zucker were running NBC. And Jeff Zucker, thanks to the Conan thing, became like a household name as reviled network executive.
For me, you know, I was happy to be there. I mean, I came from MTV, so getting a job, and Jeff Zucker was instrumental in me coming over from MTV and having this 1:30 time slot. And early on when I got there, we were seeing just the kind of the punts, if you will, of the big successful shows like Friends and ER. So there was still a lot of great morale. We were still, you know, killing it. Then it started to get bad. And then I was there for the Kevin Reilly era, which I loved. I love Kevin Reilly.
Let me just say, he was the head of NBC primetime at the time. He now runs Fox. He's been a guest on the show.
Yeah. And then I was there for the Ben Silverman era, and I got along well with Ben. But so I was there through like four different sort of owners. So when the Comcast thing happened, it just was so bad at the time. After the Leno-Conan thing, it just felt like the Comcast could be the light that like really helps us turn the page and start a new chapter at NBC.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Carson Daly, host of the NBC singing competition, The Voice, and the 1:30 a.m. late night show, also on NBC, Last Call with Carson Daly. That show has been on the air for almost 10 years, in part because of its status as what Daly calls the no-frills caboose of NBC late night.
I was kind of that last show that we never really knew what we wanted to be. We were an audience show, and we've evolved, and we've moved from New York to L.A., and our money's been cut, and we survived a rough era in the writer's strike, and, you know, certainly the economy hit everybody in business and our network, and we've just always been right on that edge where we weren't really a high priority for the network, but we were, you know, interesting.
There was some blowback when you went on the air during the strike.
Yes, there was.
What was your thinking behind that?
Well, there was some misinformed blowback. I am not a member of the Writers Guild. People think that my late night show is like Leno and Conan, like they have 14 and 16 writers. I'm only 22 minutes. I'm a half hour show. I don't do a comedy block. I don't have writers for that. First of all, we observed the strike for 2 weeks and none of us went to work. And I was glad that we were able to do that and still pay our employees. There was a time when the network came to me and said, if you don't go back on the air at such and such a date, we're firing 75 staff members, all of them. And I said, I'll be back on the air so these people could have their jobs. This was around the holidays. So we went back on the air and completely changed our format. And I just did interviews with no writing. So there was no writing for the time I was back. But the top line news story was like late night guy Carson Daly, you know, crosses line or whatever.
Right, right.
But I wasn't a member of the guild and I didn't do anything wrong.
Was it upsetting?
The only thing I focused on, and I said this when the first day I came back, was that There's a guy standing over here holding a cable in his hand, and he's holding that cable that's holding a camera that's putting my image on television. If I wasn't sitting here right now ad-libbing, that man would lose his job and 74 other people. So I just left. It never got bigger than that.
What a horrible position for me to be in.
But it was easier for me to do it because I didn't have to, you know, I don't do the type of show that Leno or Conan did.
When you were watching this debacle with Conan and Jay, I mean, that actually could have screwed up your lead in. I don't know if it affected your rating.
I got a phone call from Rick Ledwin, who, God bless Rick Ledwin.
He
runs late night TV.
Right.
Rick
at
Ledwin
NBC.
And Nick Bernstein. These are the guys. They run, you know, all late night and SNL included, and have been there for a long time. And Rick's been one of my favorite people there and a huge supporter of mine. And I think in closed rooms has probably saved my job at NBC a few times and has never told me. And I appreciate that. He called me during the Leno debacle and said, there is one potential scenario that you should know about, and I want to call you and give you a personal heads up before you read about it somewhere. And that is, there is an offer out to Conan that, long story short, might change the lineup of late night and might push you off our schedule. So when you asked about me referring to myself as the caboose, literally it was like, we might have to chop off the caboose. And that could be you, and we want you to know that. And it probably won't happen, but so now my fate is in Conan's hands. And thankfully,
he went away.
Happen. Yeah.
And your ratings went up when Leno came back, right?
Well, yeah, I don't know. We made big changes in our show, so we like to tell ourselves our ratings went up because we've switched to what we call a doc talk format, which is shot documentary style for a talk show.
Doc talk.
We have no studio audience. I do not shoot in the studio anymore. I ditch the monologue, the suit, all that stuff that I did for, you know, 7 years. We shoot totally exclusively in the real world now.
And you feel like that has helped to boost the ratings?
I know it has. I think the show's – it's an incredible show now. I do interviews now at bars with just random celebrities and people of interest for me, whether they're authors or politicians or directors or in the arts or famous or not. We do a segment with a spotlight segment, which is sort of my version of a rock and roll This American Life, a real pointed storytelling torso of the show. And then we do a music segment at the end where we go to the venues where we shoot bands in their environment. And then we put a heavy emphasis on editing, and it's a very stylized, very different looking late night show. That's just cool. Really, the most important thing here is that, like, I've had to survive at NBC late night no matter what has been put in front of me. And, you know, all of these little things I have to do to keep the brand and the show moving forward and not let the limitations of NBC, you know, really stop me.
Right. It's the thing. You're your own brand now, right? We are all supposed to be a brand.
Well,
we can't just work for somebody.
It's the entrepreneurial spirit of, I only have $100 to produce this show. This is all I can do for $100. Where I come in and say, that's not true. We can do a lot more.
I can go out.
I tell them all the time, what else? Well, we're thinking about this act, New Year's Eve. I get X amount of dollars for that show. And I go, that's $750,000 short of what it's going to take to make a good New Year's Eve show. And I produce the New Year's Eve show and host it for NBC. So I have to go out and I got to get more money.
You find a sponsor?
We do it all. Absolutely.
That's odd that you do that. Yeah. I'm sort of surprised that the NBC
doesn't manage
that.
You have to do it because no one else is going to do it for you. If I had not taken charge of the finances and the potential that was being held back from my late night show, I guarantee you I wouldn't be sitting here.
If I said, well, what is the most important thing you did to keep your show alive?
Get out of the studio. The studio costs a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Reinvent a format that works under a new, lesser economic scale. My show's a third of what it used to cost.
Wow.
And it's better.
Don't encourage them, Carson.
Right. Well, I mean, there's 16-year-old kids now making movies that are going to South by Southwest. I mean, the world's in a different place now content-wise. So if you're not constantly up to speed on how you can create a show for less that still retains quality, then it's just you're really in trouble.
Coming up after a short break, how Carson Daly went from carpooling with Tiger Woods as a teen golfer to being a radio producer for Jimmy Kimmel. Plus, a funny story from our Moth Story Slam. You're listening to The Business from KCRW and KCRW.com. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Today, we're talking with Carson Daly, host of NBC's late night show, Last Call with Carson Daly, and the NBC singing competition, The Voice. I attended the first live taping of The Voice, which took place in a hot, stuffy studio on the Warner Brothers lot in Burbank. The taping lasted 4 hours, and there were flashing lights, smoke, and all the bells and whistles of a television competition show. It was enough to give you a grand mal seizure. I was amazed at how Daly remained focused and how he never stumbled at all on live television. And this was after he'd broadcast his early morning radio show that day and was due to get up and do it again early the next morning. I asked him how he manages all these gigs and stays awake through it all.
It's easy. I remember what it was like to be broke. I made $13,000 a year when I was 22 years old, living, squatting in San Francisco. I mean, I remember my life. So everything that's happened to me now professionally, the key is to never lose perspective. I'm happy to have the work at a time when a lot of people don't even have a job. So I never once thought, boy, this studio in Burbank, Warner Brothers, is really hot. I thought,
I was thinking that. I'm really diva here.
I'm really lucky to be here. Just do the job and shut up.
Well, walk us through a little bit the career path. I mean, you didn't sit down and say, I know, I'll be a VJ on MTV, and then
no.
How did this
That's
all...
crazy. Yeah, it's crazy. No, I want to be a professional golfer. I grew up in Southern California carpooling with Tiger Woods, actually.
Are you kidding?
No, I'm not kidding.
I did not know that. You carpooled with
yes.
Tiger Woods to like...
Among other Southern... Jason
like
Gore,
a golf
professional
course?
Golfer. Yes, yeah, okay. With summer tournaments in Southern California. Well, I got a golf scholarship to college at Loyola Marymount University, where I ended up dropping out and moving to Palm Springs, which is the golf mecca, where my coach at the time was out there. My family was out there, and I enrolled in a community college there that has an excellent junior college golf program, and I majored in golf, basically. I mean, it's almost a joke because all I did was ever play golf, but I was attempting to turn pro at the time to see if I had what it took, and of course I didn't. But at that same time, I met a guy named Jimmy Kimmel, who has a late-night show on ABC.
I've heard of him. He's been a guest on our show.
And Jimmy gave me my first big break in radio. I was his morning show producer. Golf went this way, radio went that way, and that was the beginning of my long love affair with just wanting to work around music at any cost.
What do you think is what does it take to be a host? What is the skill set?
It's like golf to some degree. It takes a compartmentalized skill set. Radio has been a great training for me. You know, I have to be the ultimate communicator. And if it's music related, like The Voice is, that's why it's so easy for me to do that show. I don't ever have to look over and wonder who I'm talking to of the 16 finalists, because I'm personally off camera just by the way that I am. And the reason I'm excited about the show, I'm vested. These aren't like I'm an actor and I went home the night before and studied my notes. You know, my career, and it's funny because I actually am Catholic, and my father was in the seminary, and I contemplated going to the seminary out of high school here in Santa Monica, California. And one of the things that I did love about the priesthood, spirituality aside, was that it was a lifestyle. There was no real 9-to-5 job. You're sort of always on.
Yes.
And it's a little ironic that my career now in the music business, whether I'm hot at TRL or The Voice, or you don't know where I've been, just doing maybe a radio show or a late night show when you're asleep, it doesn't matter to me because I'm always doing something that's very organic to my lifestyle, which is discovering new music.
Carson Daly is the host of the NBC talent show The Voice and the host of NBC's late night show Last Call and a radio disc. What do I call you?
DJ, I guess. Loser?
radio DJ loser.
Radio geek.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is a real pleasure. Thank you. This will make me seem very smart to a lot of people that don't know me.
Carson Daly is a huge fan of KCRW, and he graciously stuck around and made videos with us. Go to kcrw.com/thebusiness to see him tour our music library and challenge me to a pop culture quiz in the KCRW photo gallery. And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. We had help this week from Jenny Radlett and Chloe Shipko. To leave a comment about today's show, go to our Facebook page, KCRW's The Business, or post on our website, kcrw.com/thebusiness. where you can stream or podcast the show. You can also listen to us on demand on your iPhone, Android, or BlackBerry with our KCRW apps. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.